Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hi, welcome to another episode of The Political Football, a podcast series from These Football Times. Football is a global phenomenon. People who follow it can fall into an obsessive mindset where victory or defeat for their national or club team can define their lives, attitudes and understanding of the world around them, both locally and globally. Over time, and in so many places around the world though, the game's ability to intoxicate and elicit unquestioned devotion to a cause has often been manipulated by states, parties, other political organisations, or indeed individuals seeking a way to persuade, influence and increase their power by using football as a political tool. This series looks at examples of such scenarios, considers their context, cause and effect, and how the game has been used by such political forces, and it also questions whether at times football has kicked back or provided means to counter them. This is The Political Football. And today we're going to draw a focus on Indonesia. I'm Gary Thacker. I'm delighted to say that my good friend Stu Horsfield is co-hosting the series with me, and he's back online. How are you doing, Stu?
Good, thanks, Gary. Looking forward to this one.
Yeah, I mean, we've sort of covered some subjects where, you know, like the, you know, Italy and France and Great Britain, even where, you know, we think we've got a decent knowledge, but I suppose certainly for me, Indonesia, this is going to be an absolute school day.
Yeah, it's something that I know, I'm going to hold my hands up here before we even start, and I'm pretty sure it'll become pretty clear as we go through. I know nothing about this particular subject, so I'm going to go with, there'll be a lot of questions from me, and there'll be a lot of learning from me, and there'll be a lot of stunned silence, I imagine, from me, which is not great for a podcast. So I imagine there'll be a lot of that going on. Tonight is what is how I imagine it's gonna probably play out.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. It's probably as well, mate, because I'm in the same boat as you, so it's probably as well. We've got a guy who perhaps knows a little bit more, well, probably a great deal more than we know about the subject. So who's our guest tonight, buddy?
Tonight we have Mr. Ed Norville, who is a regular contributor to These Football Times. He's also, in fact, Ed and I... Ed keeps in contact quite a lot with us over Twitter and stuff, but Ed and I certainly get engaged in various conversations online about a whole host of topics and subjects, and I'm actually really, really looking forward to hearing him speak tonight.
Fantastic. Good evening, Ed.
So, hi, how are you doing, guys? You okay?
Great, man. Well, happy to have you on board for this. For a fascinating subject.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to sort of thinking out loud and seeing where it goes and where what you guys can sort of interrogate ideas a little bit as well. So yeah.
Okay. Well, just to kick us off then, can you give us a little brief outline of the situation, include any political context about football in Indonesia?
Yeah, I can. So I, again, along with you guys, I would say I'm absolutely no expert on it. I just tried to sort of understand it in terms of overview rather than specificities. So there are some things that I wouldn't necessarily say I'll get wrong in terms of names and stuff, but I might not be, you know, quite up to date. But in general, the situation over there is that the sport is relatively new. And although there have been clubs they have got quite an extensive history, that was not really as part of organised leagues. Certainly not professional leagues. So the actual professionalisation of the sport is a very recent thing. And that makes it, I suppose, all the more unique that such sort of rampant fanaticism has emerged so quickly for a sport that is essentially so young. And that, I guess, that kind of made it stand out as somewhere that was of particular interest for... I guess it displayed or it sort of hinted at something underlying these behaviours, you know. So it seemed that football was almost an excuse or an easy outlet for these sort of like violent outbursts, for different conflicts and for sort of the fanaticism that I suppose has defined Indonesian football now.
Yeah, okay. Well, you sort of piqued my interest straight away, matey. And, you know, it's something that this area of football, this area of the world in football, is something that I guess isn't very well known. So it's going to be an interesting discussion as we go along. You mentioned about the how recent the football phenomenon is, and how quickly the anger sort of built up behind it. So why do you think that was? Was it something that it was waiting for a device to let it break out?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's pretty much spot on. I actually thought about this a little more recently, and I think the internet was probably not the underlying issues, but that was probably a catalyst for change. So the fact that happened initially, this sort of pent-up anger that you're talking about, I would say would come from things like the rampant poverty. And basically all of the teams come from areas or from cities that are very much divided between not necessarily a UK class system of sort of a working class, a middle class and an upper class, but very much a have and have not. And the have nots really do not have. And some of the sort of like the slums and I don't know what you call them, almost like a shanty town that these people come from is definitely a breeding ground for apathy, for disillusionment and for anger towards a political class. And I think that this was something that probably it manifested in violence at various points, but probably not targeted and certainly not under a certain banner. And I think with the rise of the internet and with accessibility to sort of understanding various cultures worldwide, I think that kind of gave rise to people or these fans being able to sort of latch on to something. And I think that's why you sort of see their behaviours almost coming from the sort of Italian ultra movement with the banners, the tifo, pyros, you know, everything. And then their style of dress is almost like the British casuals, you know, sort of with the brands like Lacoste, your Stone Island and Paul and Shark, all these kind of things. So I think that these feelings have always been there. And then they were sort of sharpened when the internet kind of came around. And that sort of coincides, you know, maybe a decade and a half ago or so.
Okay. Stu?
It's brilliant. I'm already right into this. I've got so many questions that I'm really sorry. I won't ask them all straight on the bounce now, but I've already got loads. So, obviously, with regards to the country then, and obviously it seems as if football is, as we've talked about many, many episodes on this, and, you know, Gary and I talk all the time about how, you know, football mirroring society and society mirroring football and so on and so on. In terms of Indonesia and this, is football the primary sport that gathers the majority of the public or the majority of these sections of society together? Or, as you've just talked about there with regards to the internet, is it something that they are just trying to replicate, having seen and learnt what's gone on in Italy, certainly, you know, in this country in the sort of 70s and 80s? Or are there other sports or other, I suppose, cultural aspects within Indonesia where these people could have attached themselves to?
Well, I would say Indonesia has a rich martial history. So they have Pencaksilat, I think, is one of their martial arts, and they have a couple other ones. And you can actually see these. You know, if you see the film The Raid, it's quite a well-known film. It's actually a Welsh director, Indonesian film. And this sort of displays this martial art, and it's done very well globally. It's had a sequel. Now the actors are in, you know, Hollywood films. So there was a rich martial culture there that I think that was probably a very, very popular outlet for people in terms of a sport. You know, from what I've gathered, although, again, I couldn't probably answer this 100% sort of correctly, but I would say that was one of the major sports before football kind of got this rise through the internet. And maybe another aspect of society that people would have gathered would have been maybe political protests, and probably as sort of a mass cultural phenomena, you could say religion as well, would probably be a place that people would gather in large groups together. And that would probably transcend class, religion, but I think, you know, as such, because so many belong to this sort of have-not sector of society, that these people would gather underneath that banner as well.
We did an episode on politics and, you know, this country more or less under the Thatcher government, and I'm not saying the government is the same there, but this whole, you know, disaffected populace and sort of the lure of football, it's almost like they're sort of not 30 years behind, but in terms of the way they're using football, there's a strong reminder from what you've said about football in this country from that late 70s, early 80s.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think when there's a period of change, I think, in countries, and the UK did go through a lot of changes then, you know, especially when we're talking about under, you know, Thatcher's government, you're talking about a lot of heavy industry closures and stuff. So I think that change, people possibly look for security in another part of their life. And if that maybe won't come from family, you'd look at it, you know, from friends. And football, certainly in the UK, that was this sort of this a place, you know, a space that people could have a common interest, and they could get on with their lives. You know, they weren't facing these sort of horrible economic sort of injustices that the rest of society was or that they'd face outside of the stadium, you know, outside of the pub.
Yeah.
And I suppose Indonesia is going through a lot of changes because it's having to grow into becoming part of a capitalistic world. And because the island is huge, because there are so many languages or so many dialects, so many religions and so many islands, you know, and the actual shape of it is difficult to govern. You know, it's a long island, and from the tip to the base is huge. I think that change isn't probably evenly spread there either. So it's not so much a case of, right, we're going to implement these sort of laws, these rules, these changes. Things take a long time there, and it's a period of negotiation. So I think football, I mean, you can maybe draw a parallel there with this sort of, with society's change, football, again, is a place that I suppose that people can find an identity as well. And that's maybe one of the more important aspects is that they've got somewhere that they feel at home, that they belong, and they're all wearing the same colour and singing the same songs. And, yeah.
It's interesting that, we've covered, I don't know how many different countries or parts of countries or parts of the globe as on these pods, but there's a fairly common theme in that although all the countries are different, the effect that football has seems to be fairly common and as a sort of tool for the underprivileged. But I think Indonesia is particularly I won't say unique. It can't be particularly unique. It's a binary state. You're unique or you're not unique. But they are. It's a very diverse country. And if people aren't aware of the, as you mentioned, the sort of different religions, different languages, and different sort of ethnic groupings that are on the island, I mean, it's a whole sort of melting pot of different people, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. And I suppose because of that, it means they have sort of numerous factors to contribute to the sort of disillusionment. You know, you have your violence, poverty, corruption in football and the government, the subsequent alienation that would bring about, and politics and religion. So all of these are potential sort of like tinder for the fire. So
yeah.
It, like I say, it's fascinating. I knew it would be. It's something I've never thought about until Ed's just mentioned it then, and that's the geographical aspect of a country. And, you know, and as Ed's just mentioned there, in terms of You know, it's the physical shape of the country, you know, the number of islands that make it up, and then how you go about governing that. And certainly, you know, as Ed's mentioned there, if changing or starting to develop into a more capitalist society, how do you go about that when geographically, you know, it seems so difficult to do? There are always going to be disparate groups who either feel left behind or where change isn't happening quickly enough. So, you know, it almost adds, you know, the actual physicalness, I know that's not a word, but go with me, that, you know, the physicalness of the country is actually an aspect that I've never considered until 30 seconds ago.
Well, I remember in geography in high school, the teacher was telling us about doing a census in a country, and she talked about places like Indonesia and like the Himalayas, for example. And she brought up the point, you know, we don't know accurately about these countries and their makeup, because we can't get censuses to certain parts, like high up in mountains. And, you know, so that kind of has always been in the back of my mind, of how the land would kind of influence things. And I think it's actually, as you say, it's actually quite easy to overlook when we think about not just with football, but wider spread. How the land, I suppose, can affect and influence people.
Yeah. And like you say as well, football clubs are relatively stable entities, aren't they? When a country or a nation is going through a period of change and they look for familiarity or stability, a football club is something that will always provide that.
Yeah, and they're a lot more stable than people think. Yeah. People talk about clubs, oh, I feel like we're going to go out of business. It happens, but it doesn't happen much. And they are definitely a lot more stable than people think. So,
you mentioned, Ed, that obviously football's a fairly new phenomenon in Indonesia, especially, I suppose, compared to the more traditional countries. So, how did that come about? Was there a nascent amateur league there before, and then professionalism came from there, or was it?
Yeah, I think there were many leagues, to be honest. And I'm not entirely sure what was sort of the impetus for professionalisation, but I believe it was just a case of leagues not going anywhere, and just a case of, right, let's get this organised, let's put a name on it. And the current incarnation of the league, I can't even remember the exact name, is very contemporary, you know. So, again, this is, I would say, it is the most stable it's ever been. And, actually, something that's interesting about the league is the first club recently just, Bally United, have recently just... sort of, what would you say, basically floated their stocks on an exchange.
Right.
So again, that's kind of just... In terms of the history, I couldn't tell you exactly why the professionalisation occurred. I think it was just a case of, this is long overdue, we need to do this. Yeah. And now, yeah, clubs are... And the league is very much consolidating itself as a permanent fixture in Indonesian society. You know, this league, as the previous ones have, predecessors have come and gone. This one, especially with this sort of recent news that's only this week that happened, or last week, I would say certainly solidifies its place, and it doesn't seem like it'll be going anywhere anytime soon. And I'd assume other clubs will begin to follow suit as well.
Right, yeah. Yeah, it tends to be the way, I guess. I mean, obviously, from what you're saying, it sounds like, and you know, as I said earlier, it's probably something that's true across the spectrum we've discussed, that football is mainly a working-class thing. So what's the government's reaction about the rise of the game there and you know, its potential political implications? Are there fears it could be a breeding ground for action, as well as resentment in some kind of... why the people can express themselves politically as well as a sport for a football club?
Yeah, well, see, do you know Guy Debord, the French sort of political theorist?
I'm afraid I don't, and I wish I should, because I haven't got a degree in political science. I probably should do, but I don't. So no, please.
He has this idea. It's the society of the spectacle.
Okay.
And it's basically that. This answer is going somewhere, by the way, just bear with me. The spectacle is basically everyday manifestations of capitalist phenomena. So celebrities, the news, advertising, films, glossy magazines, these kind of things. And I often wonder if society is like part of that spectacle, if football is part of that spectacle, or if football shatters that spectacle. And I think it has the potential to do both. And I think in Indonesia, it's at this phase where the spectacle would probably benefit a government because it's almost the opiate of the masses, you know? And as I said, celebrities, the news, advertising, it's somewhat of a distraction for the masses. And I worry that football in Indonesia might be becoming part of that spectacle where it had the potential, because initially fans organised out of anger for the government, anger against the government, it could have shattered the spectacle and it could have been an impetus for wider change to tackle things like corruption, etc. But now I think the government might be happy enough that football is as it is, because it's almost an extension to the government and it's almost a diversion in many ways from the larger scale injustices that are occurring in Indonesia.
Yeah, I guess there's a... what was the guy's name again? The political philosopher again?
Guy Debord. So it's like G-U-Y-D-E-B-O-R-D.
Okay. But it sounds like there's a sort of an echo there with Marx's idea that religion was the opium of the masses.
Yeah, I think Debord was probably a Marxist, yeah.
There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. But I absolutely understand what you're saying, and it's like that sort of if people pour their passion into football, then they're not pouring the passion into revolution. So
that's the thing. I think football, as I say, it could have been that change. It could have been the thing that came up against the government, and like the league, for example, trying to turf out corruption could have been a sort of like on the vanguard of change for which is very utopian and idealistic, but could have been the vanguard of change, or it could have shown what was capable of change within an organisation. But I just think now, because the clubs or the ultras are almost reverting to tribal lines again, and they're so busy killing each other that they're kind of, as you say, they're not focusing on a larger sort of an ideological revolution or an awakening or a paradigm shift, you know. Just busy with each other and hurting each other. So,
Stu?
This is fascinating. I was just about to ask then, actually, when you mentioned that there was real potential for almost like, you know, for mobilisation and effective social change, and I was going to ask the question of did the government somehow, you know, manipulate and negate that potential for social change through, you know, the supporting of the game or, through the investment of money? But I suppose, as you've just said there, I suppose if it's been done via a reversion to tribalism through the fans, and, you know, they've almost been more concerned with themselves and opposing fans as opposed to a wider national picture, I suppose the government for now are almost happy to sit back and let this play out and not actually have to influence at all yet.
Yeah, I mean, I think the government have people in the football organisation. As far as I remember, there are certainly crossover with who's in the government and who's in the federation of football. So I think that certainly, like, the two are maybe a little closer than you'd kind of hope for, you know, and maybe dangerously so, I suppose.
It's a nice segue into what I was going to mention to you, but I'll ask you about next. And obviously there's a lot of countries that we've looked at, the ability for corrupt corruption to intertwine into football has sort of come time and time again. So is it the Indonesian Football Association? I'm not sure what their title is, but how are they perceived by the fans and by the government? Are they seen to be a force for good, or perhaps somewhat less than that?
Yeah, so, I mean, the fans aren't fans of the Federation. Certainly not. I think because there is such a crossover between the government, it was actually founded, or partly there were clubs founded by sort of monarchy is not right because they weren't royals, but basically elite families. And in fact, the former regime, the Suharto regime, I think, was the sort of right-wing authoritarian regime that came before what they have now, which is vaguely a democracy. They actually had a team, and the team still exists. So when teams like that still exist, and there's parallels to this all over the world, military teams in Romania and I suppose franchises with like City in New York, and when teams are so linked to certain types of money and power, that separating them can be very difficult.
Yeah, I mean, we've even got football clubs owned by national governments now, aren't we? With PSG in France and Manchester City over in England as well. So
yeah,
I know what you mean, Stu.
I'm always interested in these, like Gary said, but you know, there's so much. There's a lot of mirroring goes on as we've gone through the various areas of the globe, and yet there's also so much that's different. And one of the things that I'm always interested in terms is the players' perspective and where they stand and how vocal they are, either for a political cause or against any form of establishment, or whether, as I suppose, is more inclined in this country, you know, it's very much a sort of, you know, see and not be heard, and it's, you know, footballers aren't asked for political comment, whereas you look at, you know, someone like Gerard Piqué or Socrates, you know, and these players and their social thought and their political opinions are very much sought. And I just wondered if in Indonesia, whether there was anyone there who sort of fits that sort of persona or that role.
To be honest, I have found it quite difficult to get much information on things like that, because a lot of the news with things like this tends to be not in English. But from my understanding, I'd say it would probably be more of the same, of players being seen and not heard. Most of the activism comes from fans, and I mean, Indonesia is very different to the UK in terms of how dissidents would be perceived and would be persecuted. And I think it's probably one of those things, it's maybe within a player's best interests not to say something there. Whereas the fans, as much as they face this persecution, they also have 30,000 people with machetes and stuff like that. So it's not just, you know, really, you know, it is as crazy as it is, it's not as easy to get to them as, for example, a football player. It's almost a community's voice, or not even a community, just the voice of a movement, I suppose, compared to an individual, whereas a football player would very much be the individual.
Can a club align themselves? Is there examples of clubs aligning themselves with political thought or movement?
I'm not entirely sure either. I think this club that was with the original sort of authoritarian regime, they will always have this sort of allegiance to, I can't remember if it was royalty or what they were, but they'll always have this sort of this tie. And I suppose no matter how much time changes, and even if the family aren't as directly involved as they once were, they will still have this, you know, even a reputation, like Real Madrid with being Franco's team, for example. So I think that's, with clubs, that's probably to my understanding, as far as it goes, again, I think clubs are sort of more similar to players in that they probably will be vocal about getting rid of corruption from the game, and they will certainly deny all the claims of match fixing, even though it seems that that these claims of it happening, it's repeatedly happening, and ties to sort of a mafia over there as well as the government. So there are more figures at play, you know. So I think clubs will certainly be maybe more vocal about these kind of things. But again, I would still say they'll only make comments within a certain, you know, within a certain consensus of thought. You know, I don't think any would be a particular outlier in how far they'll go to challenge these ideas.
Okay.
It's interesting you mentioned about match fixing, Ed. I mean, there was a beginning of the year, there was a guy, some high-ranking guy at the Football Association, resigned, and perhaps that was an opportunity to sort of bit of a clean sweep. But it's probably, I dip into a bit of French myself here and say, you know, it was probably a case of plus a change, plus la même chose. You know, more things change, more remain the same, because I don't think anything really changed other than the guy's name on the door.
I think that's probably right, yeah. I think it is a case of, again, people are hoping that there's going to be change. And that was is it Ide Ramayade resigned?
Yeah, that's right, yeah, I believe so, yeah.
And he did resign through forced resignation, so there was action. And yeah, the guy that was that replaced them again sort of said, you know, you've just replaced them with another puppet. But I mean, one thing you can take from that is that there was a specific task force created to deal with this, particularly like an anti-corruption task force. So at least the Madura FC boss sort of blew the whistle on how ingrained match fixing was and how deep it went in the game. So his admissions, they've implicated several senior members of the PSSI, which is their football organisation, the federation, and this has, you know, forced the police to publicly act, and they have made arrests. But whether those arrests are, you know, Berlusconi getting arrested, nudge nudge wink wink kind of thing, or if they're serious arrest remains to be seen. But, and this is maybe quite a negative thing to do with match fixing, to do with policing, but with this the stock exchange, with a team sort of floating their stocks, they will now be held to standards with financial regulators, not just the league, because they now have shareholders. So the fans now, it's almost like instead of relying on the league or the government or the police, they're kind of relying on markets to be a regulator and to police them, because when there's money involved, they do have to technically be more stringent. So this has sort of again caused a new wave of hope that this inclusion of an independent body, in this case, financial regulators, could be the prompt for significant, long-lasting change. So I guess now you'd probably be waiting to see if other clubs get on board. And, I mean, it stands to reason that if all clubs got involved, that they would really, their standards would be upheld, not because they need to for the league or for the government, but to try and supersede that and hold up these standards for the financial institution, which essentially, you know, floats their stocks, which deals with their transactions, and that does what do you call it when you're looking into a company, you're doing a
Yeah,
you know, like you're looking at everything, you know, and in this context, it will be players, who they sign for, where they sign from. And obviously the how that happened, how much was actually paid, what were the terms and conditions, because this stuff's usually, you know, left in the dark in Indonesia as well. There's a lot of, you know, under the table signings and goings on, and this can't happen. So this is kind of, yeah, ushering in this new era of hope. And if so, I suppose that would not have any parallels in world football, that the sort of federation's so inept that they would need to have a stock market be their police.
Yeah, I guess the only hope would be that the stock market isn't corrupt, and that's a whole new package.
Yes.
It's fascinating. It is absolutely fascinating. With regards to this, you mentioned earlier as well, Ed, you know, about an organised crime sort of subversive nature to, you know, within the game, or that sits within the game in terms of corruption. How in depth does that go? You know, how powerful, how long is the reach, if you like, within Indonesian football?
They probably control everything that goes on in football, to the extent where, from what I'm led to believe, it seems like even certain players maybe that are playing a game wouldn't quite understand how involved their own team maybe would have been in, I suppose you could say, throwing the game, you know. So I suppose it's very difficult to answer, because it could just take one player on the pitch, like the goalkeeper, Karius for Liverpool, who in the championship was absolutely paid to do that. And these kind of things, it could just be one player, it could be a whole team, it could be a manager, it could be both teams aware of each other. I'm really not sure, but it seems to be that what they say would go. You know, be that the collusion between sort of these mafias and the government, or if that would just be one sort of nefarious force for one game. You know, I think it really does depend, but far-reaching would certainly be true.
Just in case any lawyers are listening, just want to sort of emphasise that Ed wasn't suggesting that Karius threw one in back of the net on purpose. It was just emphasising there that
how a
goalkeeping error can be misinterpreted as something else. You know, Karius obviously just an unfortunate in that game.
Do you not think he threw that? No.
I'm trying to keep us from getting prosecuted.
Yeah, I'm surprised we haven't been already.
I'm sure it didn't, and you know. You make a good point, and it is sometimes difficult to distinguish between, you know, especially for a goalkeeper, where an error tends to end up with the ball in the back of the onion bag, and when sometimes, you know, we all make mistakes, and goalkeeping errors can look.
And the thing is, like everyone says, you know, if you make one bad shot at golf, the worst thing you can do is take another bad one after it, and the pressure is unbelievable. So, yeah, absolutely. But I mean, in Indonesian football, you do see these kind of things, and you wouldn't be taking it as lightly as you would with, or not as lightly, but you wouldn't brush it off as an error. And that's the thing. There's also this almost culture of paranoia as well.
Yeah.
You know, that I say a Karius incident wouldn't exist there without, right, he's thrown that, you know.
I understand, yeah, I understand what you're saying. Yes, sorry, still, I could have cost you, mate.
No, I was just going to ask, you know, with regards to, obviously there's a lot of money involved, I guess, in the football, and there's certainly a lot of vested interest. And when, you know, and you mentioned about, you know, the club that's now aligning itself to regulation via financial authorities, and I just wondered if there's you know, sort of any sort of pushback or kickback. You know, you say some of the, it'll be interesting to see whether clubs take that further forward and more clubs go and do it. But I suppose it's also interesting as to whether there's any, you know, hidden or subversive forces that are pushing against that and sort of trying to prevent clubs, more and more clubs, from doing that. Because I guess the more clubs that do it, the more, you know, they'll start to relinquish control and their grip on the game.
Yeah, but I mean, control certainly seems to be a part of what the government do with football and with everything almost. And I mean, in a sense, like, you understand it because the country is so large and is so diverse, ideologically diverse as well, because there are many religions, many languages, many cultures. So I think this does pose a real threat, and as you said, you would hope that the financial corruption would sort of not succumb to the same sort of corruption. You know, the financial institutions will not have this kind of same illegal goings on, which is very believable, as the league does. So, yeah, the league might feel, or the federation or the government might feel like they are relinquishing a little bit too much power, unless they are somewhat involved in this too. And that is obviously conspiracy, but just purely to say that that these things are possible, and we do need to think that if significant changes to occur, that this might be the way, but this might not be the way. And, you know, possibly the league will put up some resistance to this happening if it is seen as a viable way out for the teams. That's a very strange thing. It would almost be like a decentralized football league. You know, it's like it's unfathomable. If it does go ahead, how much these financial institutions are. Because I don't know the market that they're floated on, you know, so I don't know if it's an Indonesian one or who's behind sort of who watches the watchmen, you know. And I think these are sort of the paranoid fears that are being aired, you know, with these moves, and it happens all the time, of is this change or is this just a cover for more of the same, like false hopes of change. And it's very hard to tell, obviously, at this point.
Yeah, it's very difficult. And, you know, there's an inherent danger with any organisation that has money involved as its core activity. And, you know, stock markets are as corrupt as any other organisation, you know, in my limited experience. We mentioned about the corruption generally, and that some clubs were owned by the elites of the country and by perhaps government or ex-government organisations, there was mafia involvement. So what's the corruption? I mean, it might be an answer that is, you're not sure, or it might be an answer that all of the items are suggested here. So was the corruption driven by power, by money, by political influence, or was there something else behind that? Or was it a combination of them all, do you think?
I would probably say... I would say it's an easy answer, but I'd say it would be a combination of them all, in a sense, because the power is, again, for a government that has to deal with such a diverse sort of landscape, cultural landscape, they do need to retain some degree of power. You know, they do, because it's it would be unfathomable to govern, and that's how they're the authoritarian regime was so widespread, was for a while so accepted, and obviously it had such devastating ends also, that I think this idea of power was a large driver behind it. I suppose they need to portray themselves also globally as something clean, as a government that doesn't have dirty hands, and they also need to it would be within their best interest to clean football up.
Yeah, so it's almost laundering their image as much as anything else as well.
Yeah, I think so. As much as it is to do with power and money and politics and things like that, I think it's it would be a combination of them all. But I do think it would be, within their best interests to also use that, to use football as a tool. And I think the tool just now, they're seeing it in a very localised manner, which is to control, as you're saying, with power, their own people. But perhaps, you know, it would maybe be more beneficial if it was sort of yielded in another way.
Yeah. Stu?
Yeah, I've got... So that, I suppose it's a question, but I'm not sure you're going to be able to answer it. Not because I don't think you can. I'm just not sure I can word it correctly. To an average club, then, an average Indonesian club, you know, we've talked about certain, you know, government influence. We've talked about, you know, the ultras. We've talked about organised crime. In a regular top flight Indonesian club, who controls the clubs? Who controls the club decisions? And are the majority of them free from, you know, any sort of are clubs free to, you know, to make free choices and free will? Or are all clubs, is there a hierarchy, I suppose, that sits within all clubs, be it, like, say, the fans or government or organised crime or, you know, it's that, I think, that I'm interested in.
Yeah, I think as you'll see in many places, the clubs will probably make the decisions. They will probably consult members of the ultras groups. And you see this in Europe as well, you know. You see it in Eastern Europe, I lived in Portugal for a few years, you've seen it big time in Portugal, you know. Especially the incident with Sporting Lisbon happened, probably 1 year ago now, with the ultras. The players refused to play a cup game. I can't remember the exact reason, if it was to do with one of their chairman resigning or a manager or something. So the ultras just sort of broke into the training yard and attacked the players, like, badly, you know, with belts, and it was bad, you know. And this was basically because the club made a decision against the wishes of the ultras group. And I think it's the same in Indonesia. I think it'd be the case of the clubs would make decisions first and foremost for the club, but with consultation with, you know, with the government, I'd think would definitely still happen, and with their ultras. And I think that would influence these decisions greatly. And I think they would do their best to please the most amount of people they could.
I mean, you know, when you talked about paranoia within the game, even from, you know, what could be classed as a, you know, as a basic error, if you like, is looked upon with suspicion. But it almost seems there's so many people involved, there's so much paranoia, there's so much at stake that clubs and decision making to me would almost be paralyzing for fear of making the wrong choice or the wrong decision, or consulting and being guided by the wrong people within your club.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's also the idea of not only how the league is seen globally, but how much the federation cares about how much or what people think of them. I mean, when there was a fan at the start of this year was killed, it was when Persija from Jakarta were playing Persib Bandung, and the clubs are about a four-hour drive from each other, so given the size of the country, it's somewhat of a local derby, you know. And these are the two sort of big teams that you know, your Celtic and Rangers of Indonesian football.
Yeah.
And they tit for tat kill each other, and it happens a lot. But the at the start of the year, there was a younger boy killed, and he was it was on video, and it's horrific. And then there's been, this is sort of, I guess it has caused, actually, believe it or not, the ultras are the ones who are saying, right, enough's enough. But the clubs themselves, they just didn't seem to, or the federation, sorry, the clubs did. They said, you know, this is terrible. But the federations, and it's like the government, just seemed to not care too much, you know. Again, paying lip service to, right, we need to make a change, and that was all they could really do in that case, like, or all they thought they could do is, you know, yeah, this is bad, we're really sorry, let's do something, and then it was more of the same. So, it just seems like the decision making is not just about you know, fear of reprisal in terms of who you could offend, but it's you're talking about people getting killed here as well, you know, and the decisions they have sort of real life effects, and you know, in many games you can only bring home fans, will only go, as is the case in other places in Europe, you know. But in this game that wasn't the case, and that sometimes was the case between these two teams. So it's even these kind of decisions, you know, it's not just repercussions of an angry mobster, it's repercussions of innocent boys getting killed. So it's a serious, serious issue that goes well beyond just politics or religion. It's like, it's even the logistics of a game and making decisions, you know, regarding routes that these buses are going in and whether away fans should be allowed to go. And it's I don't think there is anywhere in the world that football is as mad as it is in Indonesia. And yeah, I suppose that's what makes it unique. You know, as we said right at the start, it's because these ultras have only been around for about 10, 15 years. And they're literally like, I suppose, in some ways have aligned themselves with your mafia and your clubs and government in terms of the sway they hold. And I mean, there's certainly they organise like militias, and they have like training camps and young kids coming through the ranks and like young kids, you know, all decked out in the printed T-shirts with the Ultras logo, and it's seriously organised, you know. So these decisions affect a myriad of different things.
With that in mind, Ed, I mean, across the series we've done it, Stu's got a reputation for asking the impossible questions, and I've got a reputation for trying to do the same and failing miserably. But I'm going to try again here. So I want to ask you to just open your crystal ball and look 10 years into the future. I mean, tell me what Indonesian football looks like in 10 years' time.
You've got to be realistic, eh? And you're going to say if this... Because that was totally unexpected, the thing with the stock exchange, for me anyway, because I'm not up to date in, like, you know, like Indonesian affairs, as it were. That was totally out of the blue. So I think if this does affect a significant change, then we might see something positive. But at the same time, realistically, like, football ebbs and flows at the same time as society. And corruption might lessen with one government, but it can increase with the next one. And as long as there are even just the most minor of lapses, people are going to remain sceptical and they're going to remain paranoid. And there's going to be a push for change and there's going to be a push against it. Ultras groups are now coming forward and asking for there to be less violence, particularly untargeted violence, because killing each other, I mean, that is their game, you know, or part of their game. But when it's innocent people, I think that's something everyone gets behind and just not being good, you know. And that's something that I think that does look like it's the first time that a sort of consensus has been reached in terms of what they're going to do, or at least a goal in moving forward to be in reducing this violence. I mean, it's a country that is so vast, the bureaucracy is very slow and sort of entrenched in this like mire of agendas and vendettas. So you've got to be proactive, because if you're left to sleep, you'll get stuck, you know. And I think that's the key, is that there are certain non-government organisations trying to sort of be proactive, you know, trying to kick corruption out. And I think these little groups as well, as futile as they might seem, are actually very significant in keeping names in the paper and words on people's lips. So I think, although there are positive changes, which there are, positions can change and things change, but attitudes rarely do. So it might even be a case of, as much as it would be great if football could change, and there are things that are hinting that football will change, it could be something far greater than that, and it's actually that we'd be waiting on societal change. We'd be waiting on governments becoming less corrupt.
Fair comment, Stu?
I quite like your question, Gary. I'm going to take your question and just almost narrow it down a bit, I suppose. In terms of, for you, Ed, what is the number one priority? You know, we've talked about, you know, what it would look like in 10 years' time, and like you say, you've got to be realistic, etc. But in terms of, you know, don't worry about the logistics of whether it could happen or can't happen. You know, for a second, that's irrelevant. But for you, what is the number one priority for Indonesian football today in order for it to thrive and be successful in the future?
Yeah, so it would be knocking out this paranoia of corruption. And I think I'd say most fans would agree with me on that, because I've spoken to quite a few and I've read a fair bit. And I think for that to happen is, again, idealistically, you would gut the federation and you'd start again. And you would have, I don't know, non-Indonesian people coming in as well. You know, maybe like a board built from various nations, so they have less of a vested interest in what's happening. And it would have to be a restock of like the PSSI and stuff, because as it is it seems to be one in, one out, one in, one out, and same old, so... Okay. It has to be a complete restock.
OK. Tom's always our enemy on this, and, you know, I'm sure Stu will agree we could talk for hours, but we just don't have that time. And we always like to finish with the same question on physical football. So... the question obviously relates to football in Indonesia, and it's this. So can football exist in a political vacuum, or does the passion engendered by the game too easily lend itself to being a political tool? In short, is the political football inevitable in Indonesia?
Yeah, I mean, I would say in Indonesia it's inevitable. I think because of the from the very start, when you have teams, you know, as part of the Suharto regime that had the team from Solo, it was always going to be politicised in some way, and this team still holds their sort of right-wing affiliations with pride somewhat, despite personnel changes. So I think it has always been inevitable, and it will always be inevitable, because beyond... left and right wing, there's this consensus of alienation and a class struggle. And when there's such deeply entrenched and quite horrific poverty, that there's always going to be a political element of us against them, and of football being a sort of an outlet for people. So in that sense, I think it is inevitable, yeah.
Yeah, one day I'm going to ask this question of one of our guests, and they're going to say no.
Well, can I just quickly say something? Right? I think there is a no coming up, because Canada's got a league that just started this year. It starts 2019. There's only 7 teams in it just now, but it's the Canadian Premier League. And I think you've seen politics slightly coming to the fore in the American one, and the MLS, sorry, not the American one. And these teams aren't overtly political, but some of them kind of are, because, you know, like Portland Timbers, kind of hipster, vegan stuff and all that.
That's right.
But I think in Canada, we might see even less of that. And I think it might be sports for sport's sake. So I think you will get an answer soon, I think.
If anybody's out there and wants to come on and talk about Canadian football and how this might happen in Canada, that would be fantastic.
But, yeah, I mean, to listen to that, yeah. If someone knows a lot more about it than we do, it would be great.
But we do have listeners all over the globe, so, you know, yeah. Anybody out there in North America, drop us an email at These Football Times. You'll find my Stuart and my connection details on the tweets when we put out the podcast, so drop us a line and we'd love to have someone to talk about this league, and perhaps I will get this no answer. But I want to say a massive thanks, Ed.
Thank you for having me on.
No, when we started this, I knew nothing about Indonesian football. I want to say I know a lot now, but I certainly know a hell of a lot more than I did. And you know, it's certainly a fascinating subject as well.
Yeah, it's one of those, the more you read, the less you know as well. You know, things get confused, yeah. In my own answers and my own thoughts, so.
Now, you only know a lot about anything when you know a little, you know.
Yeah.
Final thoughts, Stu?
I'm so embarrassed by my lack of knowledge about Indonesia. While you were just chatting there, I've just brought up Indonesia on the internet, and when you talk about the size of it and you actually see it on the globe, I had no idea. It's this is going to sound awful. It's sort of wider than Australia, and the way it comes down, it's incredible. It is unbelievable how big it is.
In the top 10 largest landmasses in the world.
Yeah, obviously I'm not on Wikipedia, but I'm on Wikipedia just to get some quick facts, and it is unbelievable. Just looking at it on the globe, and I had no idea. It was so vast.
And that's why it's as harsh as it can sound about the government having to retain an element of control. They do, kind of, because, I mean, there are other ways to govern, but in the current system that they have, they need to maintain some degree of control because it's just an insane place. Yeah. You know, like, geographically, it's just the magnitude of the place is unfathomable, you know. Yeah. So
I feel like it should come with a precursor to this, Gary, where obviously this is all at the end, but it should come with just have a look at Indonesia before you start listening, just to get, because honestly, the minute I saw it, I was just like, oh my God, yeah. And it need a picture to go alongside it.
Yeah, but you know what people should do, Stu? They should listen to it first and catch this at the end and then listen again. So we'll get double listening.
Yeah, to be fair, yeah. And then they can start talking about Guy Debord as well, and they can have all sorts of extra learning.
So anyway, that was fantastic conversation with Ed, and we've sort of learned so much about Indonesia, and I hope all the listeners have too. It's been educational. I mean, literally educational. I'm sure Stu will agree.
You're kidding.
So, thanks everybody for listening, and catch us next time where we'll be looking at another subject on how football and politics are intertwined throughout the world. This is the Political Football. Good night.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.